From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In the aftermath of a massive police and military crackdown on opposition groups in the south and east of Ukraine, a call for de-escalation from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Nikki Chadwick, reports.
All sides involved in the crisis in Ukraine have been urged to make greater effort to find a peaceful resolution to the current situation, especially in towns in eastern and southern Ukraine that have seen increasingly violent confrontations. Rupert Colville, spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, says that the government must ensure that military and police operations are in line with international standards and that they scrupulously protect the human rights of all, including the Russian-speaking population. He's calling on armed opposition groups to stop all illegal actions, including detaining people and seizing public buildings. He says that a peaceful resolution must be found.
Inclusive and participatory dialogue needs, as a matter of urgency, to be undertaken at all levels to de-escalate tensions and prevent further violence. Leaders at national and local levels need to take serious steps to halt the rhetoric of hatred and confrontation before the situation spirals totally out of control.
In addition, he says that peaceful demonstrations must be allowed, not only to comply with international law, but also as a release valve for people's legitimate fears and frustrations. He says that there is an urgent need to create an environment where freedom of expression and opinion are fully respected. Nikki Chadwick, United Nations, Geneva.
Despite the call, there were reports late Tuesday that Ukrainian special forces had begun storming checkpoints in Mariupol in the Donetsk region, Ukraine's southeast. According to the city's local self-defense volunteers, there was a massive attack on the checkpoints located in the western part of the city, with intensive shooting heard in the downtown. According to one source, there are dead. RT reported that the military operation continued Tuesday in a number of cities and towns in the Donetsk region, with less than 20 days left until the presidential elections set by the Kiev government for May 25th. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov questioned the idea of holding elections during the current crisis, as Press TV's Omaleski reports.
Russia has taken a swipe at Ukraine for its plan to hold a presidential election during the ongoing crisis in the country.
Holding elections at a time when troops are being deployed against part of the population is arguably an unusual phenomenon. This is not Afghanistan, where elections are held despite an ongoing war.
The Russian foreign minister says holding new crisis talks in Geneva is pointless, as an earlier agreement has not been implemented yet. Lavrov says such negotiations would be successful if the representatives of Ukraine's Russian-speaking regions were also involved. He says the protesters in southeast of the country want to make their voice heard. Lavrov made the remarks in Vienna after a meeting of the Council of Europe. Ukraine is scheduled to hold an election on the 25th of May.
Meanwhile, the Obama administration has sent a top Treasury Department official to Europe this week to discuss a possible new round of sanctions against Russia. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe has more.
Treasury Undersecretary David Cohen will visit Germany, France, and Britain to examine more severe sanctions against Russia in talks with European partners. The U.S. Treasury has warned that if the situation on the ground worsens in Ukraine, Washington and its allies will consider tougher moves, such as targeting entire sectors of the Russian economy. They have already imposed sanctions on Russian individuals and businesses, accusing Moscow of supporting anti-Kiev groups in eastern and southern Ukraine. Russia denies the claim. Let's bring in Stephen Lemon. He's a writer and radio host who joins us from Chicago to share his thoughts on this. Stephen Lemon, I'm getting a feeling that it's do or die time here for Europe, in particular Germany, because if you're having this Undersecretary General for the U.S. Treasury Department visiting first Europe in order to discuss sanctions, that's when Europe has to decide whether they're going to go with more severe sanctions based on U.S. call or not. How do you see it?
German Chancellor Angela Merkel was in Washington late last week meeting with Obama. Well, the public comments from Merkel belies what she really believes. I wrote about strong opposition in Germany from important business leaders, major companies, BASF, Siemens, Deutsche Bank, other major German companies. They absolutely oppose sanctions that affect their business, their revenues, their profits, and Merkel represents them. She will in no way impose sanctions that will harm German industry. And the same feeling is felt across Europe. European trade with Russia is about $400 billion annually. It's a small fraction of that between Russia and America. So the undersecretary can go to Europe and he can bully and he can pressure, which is what Washington does, Kaveh. Well, European countries will do a little bit. They'll target Russian officials, but they'll do nothing to affect the business interests of their companies. And I think that pretty much is what will happen.
And you know, what's interesting, Stephen Lemon, is the fact that there was a report out saying that dozens of CIA, FBI agents advising the Ukrainian government. Aside from that being a headline, what's interesting is that this is a German press that is reporting that. So on the one side, I think it shows that Germany is trying to separate itself from the U.S., but more so, and more importantly, if you can give your comments on how these dozens of CIA, FBI agents are actually advising the government. I mean, do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Not just the German press, cover, but a major German newspaper, Bild am Sonntag, the number one Sunday newspaper in Germany, the largest circulation. It printed the story. Dozens of FBI and CIA agents directing in Kiev, directing Kiev policy, and the policy comes right out of Washington, and the policy is wage war on Eastern Ukrainians, wage war on freedom, institutionalized fascism. This is what the story is. It's a very ugly, dirty story. Literally, it's Obama's war on freedom, wanting to crush freedom in Ukraine, literally support these fascist extremists. I call them Obama's new friends. It's a deplorable situation. And the real threat, Kaveh, most of all, and this affects countries all over the world and people all over the world, there is a serious threat of a major East-West confrontation meeting America versus Russia. And if Russia and America get into a confrontation and it turns belligerent, there's the risk of a possible, dare I suggest, the unthinkable, a nuclear confrontation. I mean, we're literally heading for this possibility. I don't say it'll happen, and I'm certainly not predicting it, but the threat is there. It's a greater threat than ever existed during the Cold War. Nothing like this existed during the Cold War. And the rhetoric and the propaganda and the vicious lies coming out of the capitals of mainly Washington and the major media, the U.S. media mainly, the European media also, but mainly the U.S. media, including the New York Times and all the television broadcasters and cable channels, they're all in unison about this. They're literally promoting a possible war.
And while the administration seems perfectly content with repeated efforts to punish the world's second largest nuclear power, here at home, they're a bit more timid. Last year, despite massive evidence of money laundering related to terrorist financing and drug trafficking by megabank HSBC, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder did not prosecute the bank or any of its employees, instead accepting a $1.92 billion settlement that critics said represented a mere fraction of the profit earned on the illegal activity. When queried by a Senate committee, Holder had this to say.
I am concerned that the size of some of these institutions becomes so large that it does become difficult for us to prosecute them when we are hit with indications that if you do prosecute, if you do bring a criminal charge, it will have a negative impact on the national economy, perhaps even the world economy. And I think that is a function of the fact that some of these institutions have become too large. Again, I'm not talking about HSBC. This is just a more general comment. I think it has an inhibiting influence on, in impact on our ability to bring resolutions that I think would be more appropriate.
But Holder appeared to backpedal from that position on Monday.
There is no such thing as too big to jail. Some have used that phrase to describe the theory that certain financial institutions, even if they engage in criminal misconduct, should be considered immune from prosecution due to their sheer size and their influence on the economy. That view is mistaken, and it is a view that has been rejected by the Department of Justice. To be clear, no individual or company, no matter how large or how profitable, is above the law. When the Department of Justice conducts investigations, we will always follow the law and the facts wherever they lead. When laws indeed appear to have been broken, and the evidence supports the allegations, a company's size will never be a shield from prosecution or penalty. I am personally monitoring the status of these ongoing investigations. I am resolved seeing them through, and in doing so, I intend to reaffirm the principle that no individual, no entity that does harm to our economy is ever above the law.
The Attorney General's comments Monday came as European banks PNB Paribas and Credit Suisse were, according to various media reports, in talks to settle allegations of money laundering. Professor William Black is an associate professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. He spoke with Radio VR's Kels Hetherington.
There should never be any entity beyond the rule of law, or there is no rule of law. In addition, his argument was always absurd, right? You should be prosecuting the senior officers. And nobody thinks that prosecuting the senior officers will cause any banks to fail. So there was never a dilemma facing them. It was always simply an excuse that the industry was giving for not prosecuting. Of course, the facts are clear. We are all to the near the midpoint of 2014, and there has not been a single elite Wall Street banker whose crimes actually helped drive the crisis who has been convicted.
When did the Attorney General actually say that some banks were too big to prosecute?
About 4 months ago, and he said Congress. And he got, of course, instant criticism for it, so he's been trying to walk it back ever since.
Yeah, and actually in today's statement, he says a little bit of that same thing, and we'll get to that in a few moments. But Professor Black, Attorney General Eric Holder goes on to say in this week's message that sometimes a company's conduct may be wrong, may be hard to defend, but not necessarily violate the law. Or sometimes there may be an appearance of criminal wrongdoing that cannot be supported by evidence, admittable in court. Professor Black, that sounds like lawyer speak to me. What is he really talking about here? It sounds like he has some specific financial institution or institutions in mind.
His point is the statement obviously is true. It's been true in all eras. Not all things are crimes. Not all crimes that you believe exist can you necessarily prove. It has nothing to do with anything, right? This is by a very large measure the largest, financially the most destructive. A lot of it was absolutely blatant, easily prosecutable stuff. For example, the foreclosure frauds, where people knowingly filed hundreds of thousands of false affidavits. Well, those are crimes, and a prosecutor on a panel with me recently said that those are no-brainers. They found Standard Chartered to be training people in how to violate our laws and file false entries, and they refused to prosecute anyone, and that was allegedly sanctions busting from Iran, which, by the way, is in their new campaign of press leaks. They say they're going to go after a foreign bank, Paribas, because it assisted in the breaching sanctions on Iran.
Yeah, BNP Paribas and Credit Suisse are both facing possible charges, but it looks like BNP Paribas is the one that indirectly laundered money to Iran.
Two foreign banks, no U.S. banks, And they're not really allegations yet, but they would rather do some action against some foreign, for some had nothing to do with creating the crisis. And again, I'm happy that if they will start enforcing the laws against anyone, that would be a good thing in the white collar sphere. But it nothing to do with the crisis, won't get deterrence against the things that caused the crisis, and still. Right now, they're batting. If you know, if they were a baseball team, they'd go 0-0 against the folks that caused the crisis.
After Mr. Holder says how he's committed to being tough on banks that abuse the law, he then says what really sounds like doublespeak, and what you were talking about a few moments ago, because he says, quote, "But when laws appear indeed to have been broken and the evidence supports the allegations, a company's size should not be a shield from prosecution or penalty." That makes sense. And then he follows that with, it is true that criminal charges involving a financial institution can sometimes trigger serious follow-on actions by that company's financial regulators in some cases. And the AG says it may even trigger the loss of the institution's charter. And for that reason, Mr. Holder said, in preparing a case, it would be irresponsible for a prosecutor not to consider that fact first. So he's saying exactly what you're saying. Anyone can be prosecuted. And then he's saying, but we need to think very carefully before we move with charges against large financial institutions. Is that what you hear him saying as well?
No, it's actually worse than that. We have laws that say that if a big bank commits the following crimes, it should lose its charter. We find that it committed those crimes, and therefore we're not going to prosecute because we don't want to remove the charter, which the law says we should remove the charter. So that's not, he's contradicting himself. And it would be irresponsible to do what he's suggesting. In other words, if you find out that a very large bank is controlled by criminals, why in God's name would you leave the criminals in charge of that bank? And then claim that the reason you were doing it was to safeguard the financial safety of the industry by leaving criminals in charge of some of the largest in the world. They need to get the crooks out of running the largest banks is a demonstration of how beyond the pale Holder and all of the top regulators.
They're not even talking about bringing criminal action against those who run the banks. They're just talking about indicting the actual institution, right?
That's correct. And note that they virtually never even try to get back the fraud proceeds from the senior officers. So the senior officers run the bank, loot the bank, become wealthy by looting it, cause huge losses to it, get sued eventually, personally sued, even though they're the ones who got wealthy from it, they sue the bank, and then the CEO who controls the bank is happy to trade off a higher settlement from the bank in return for getting immunity both from criminal prosecution and not having to give back fraud proceeds.
In prosecuting the financial institutions themselves, and what you say is absolutely right, but in terms of prosecuting the financial institutions, what Mr. Holder appears to have said today is that, yes, we will go after them with criminal prosecutions, but there is a higher standard of proof that applies here, higher burden of proof. So, yes, we'll go after them, but no time soon. Correct?
No, again, I think it's worse than that.
Okay.
I think he said we won't go after them, even if we have the proof, if it would result in their charter being.
Yes, but the Raw Story website is reporting that senior officials at the Justice Department have said that Holder's remarks this morning come amidst investigations into BNP Paribas, and you mentioned that, as well as Credit Suisse. BNP Paribas is under investigation over allegations of money laundering and for breaching U.S. financial sanctions against certain third parties. And Credit Suisse faces a separate inquiry into claims that it helped U.S. citizens evade taxation by sheltering their funds abroad. So it does sound like we are moving forward with some prosecutions, but it's at a snail's pace.
We have known about Credit Suisse's frauds for at least 6 years, and those frauds were extraordinary. They're a full-service bank. Now, mind you, this is to the wealthiest of Americans who already had one of the tax rates in American history. They still aren't willing, and the seemingly helped them violate the law. In some cases, even smuggled assets for them in the form of diamonds, which they hid in toothpaste, of all things. When they were caught, they stonewalled the United States government for years. They lied to the United States government, and we still haven't prosecuted them. And now the Justice Department wants credit for finally, as the statute of limitations is probably about to run on many of these crimes, saying that it's going to seek something against some part of Credit Suisse. Paribus is alleged not only to have violated those sanctions, but again to have lied, but trained its staff and how to hide the violations, and to then stonewall the United States and lie to the United States in the investigations, which is precisely what Standard Chartered pledged to do, and it got away with clean.
There's a lot of
that let HSBC get away with it, but maybe they will crack down a little bit. Purpose.
Credit Suisse apparently may face a really severe fine, $780 million. I guess the total amount of your penalty in dollar terms, really, we need to compare that against how much you profited from the crime to say if it's large or not. But $780 million, that sounds like a lot of money. And it would be more than Swiss rival UBS paid to U.S. authorities in 2009. But my question for you, Professor Black, is why would the U.S. be so hesitant to bring charges against these two large financial institutions, both Paribas and Credit Suisse?
Well, there's no good reason. And the dollar amount is large compared to, you know, most things we deal with in life. But compared to Credit Suisse's size, it's tiny. It is literally the cost of doing fraud, which is the Credit Suisse's business plan in very large part.
Yeah.
Not going to deter. No one thinks it's going to deter. And I'll tell you why it inherently cannot under the Holder Doctrine. Because the Holder Doctrine, and you just gave a version of it when you said, oh, we couldn't possibly prosecute if they would lose their charter. So the Holder Doctrine says that they are too big to prosecute if it would, quote unquote, cause their failure. Of course, it's not causing their failure. Their crimes caused their failure.
Right, of course.
But that means that the fine can never be significant.
Yeah, the holder seems to think that any penalty is too much.
It would potentially cause the bank to fail, again with the word cause in quotation marks.
Right.
And therefore, all settlements must definitionally, under the Holder Doctrine, be relative to the size of the bank, insignificant.
Opponents of prison mass incarceration and solitary confinement held a protest Monday in Albany, New York, condemning the new Jim Crow, with the U.S. disproportionately locking up African Americans and labeling them as criminals, perpetuating a racial caste system. About a third of young black men in the U.S. are either in prison, on parole, or on probation, with incarceration rates far higher than any other industrialized nation. Protesters voiced support for a proposed HALT bill, the Humane Alternatives to Long-Term Solitary Confinement Act, which would ban the holding of inmates in isolation cells for more than 15 days at a time. Currently in New York, about 3,800 people are in special housing units, or SHUs, with many more in other forms of isolated confinement in the state's prisons on any given day, held for 23 to 24 hours in cells smaller than the average parking space, alone or with one other person. More than 800 are in solitary confinement in New York City's jails, along with hundreds more in local jails across the state. Professor Cornel West spoke to the protesters following a news conference in support of the proposed halt bill.
Let me say, I would not want to be in any other place than this spot to stand with you to let the world know that we gonna stay in contact with the humanity of our brothers and sisters who are disproportionately chocolate, but whatever color they are, we stand with them no matter what the system has to say. Oh yeah. We come with the spirit of John Coltrane. It's a love supreme. It's a love supreme. And when you love folk, you can't stand the fact they're being treated unjustly. You loathe the fact that they're being treated unfairly. And if we don't do something, the rocks are gonna shut out. That's why we're here. We're here to straighten our backs up and let the world know, let the system know, let these folk in this house, the White House, City Hall, anywhere in the nation, that when it comes to the Jim Crow Jr., the new Jim Crow system, we say it is a crime against humanity. That's what it is. Solitary confinement is torture. That's a crime against humanity. To lock folk up when 60% of them are there for soft drugs, and everybody knows 12% of those on the chocolate side, 12% of those on the vanilla side are flying high in the friendly skies every week taking drugs, but 65% of the convictions are chocolate. That just lets us know that the legacy of white supremacy is still operating in America. Oh, yes. But it's not just that, but it's also a class issue. Everybody knows that if not just our precious white and vanilla brothers and sisters, but if middle class young folk of any color were going to jail at the same level of intensity as our precious poor brothers and sisters, disproportionately chocolate, that'd be a town hall meeting every week. It'd be on ABC, NBC, MSNBC, maybe even Fox News would have to carry it. Let's just tell the truth. The condition of truth is always to allow suffering to speak, just like the love is always connected to justice. Justice is what love looks like in public, just like tenderness is what love feels like in private. I come from a people who've been terrorized, traumatized and stigmatized for 400 years, but we still understand what it is to stand up for justice and still connected to a radical tenderness and a militant gentleness and a subversive sweetness, even as we're willing to live and die for the cause of justice. That is what is necessary now. Thank God for Sister Michelle Alexander in her text, The New Jim Crow. Thank God for Angela Davis on the front line for over 40 years. Thank God for Glenn Lowry. Thank God for Mumia Abu-Jamal on the front for over 30-some years. Oh, give all of our political prisoners who have suffered indescribably a hand. Just give them a hand. Let's just stop this moment. We'll never forget your sacrifice. No matter how much they're abused, we'll never forget what they stood up for. I see Brothers Larry Mamiya in the crowd from Vassar. He wrote the great text on the history of the black freedom struggle filtered through the black church. Well, we are here because we want to make the connection between the Jim Crow Jr., the new Jim Crow, which is the prison industrial complex, to the Wall Street oligarchic complex, where 1% of the population owned 42% of the wealth, where 40% of our precious red children, brown children, black children live in poverty, where 22% of all of our precious children live in poverty in the richest nation of the history of the world. That is morally obscene and spiritual. spiritually profane. There's a connection between wrestling with these issues and wrestling with what Martin Luther King Jr. gave his life at the end, connecting, eradicating poverty with the military-industrial complex.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.